You're tuned into the Awakening Zone Radio Network, your news and information source for empowered spiritual awakening.
Hello, this is Karen Elkins, and welcome to Science to Sage Radio. Our guest today is Larry Dossey, and I'm grateful that he's here on the show. And if you're tuned into Blog Talk Radio, turn into Awakening Zone, and that way you can actually listen and ask questions if you'd like. So let me introduce Larry. He's an MD and a leader in bringing scientific understanding to spirituality and a rigorous proof to complementary and integrative medicine. Larry is an integrated internal medicine physician, former chief of staff of the Medical City Dallas Hospital, and a former co-chair of the Panel of Mind, Body, and Intervention, National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicines, and the National Institute of Health. He is the author of a New York bestseller, Healing with Words, and 11 other books that have been translated and published around the world. Larry's new book, One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness, is why it matters. His premise is that the individual mind are all part of an infinite collective dimension of a consciousness he calls the One Mind. And his book offers a way to understand the great mysteries of our experience and our existence, and so that we might gain a greater understanding of who and why we're here and what we're up to. And there was a part of in reading Larry's book, I really loved the humbleness in the beginning, Larry. Larry's here, so welcome, Larry.
Karen, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And there's one part in the intro of the book I think is quite a telling thing. It's when I'll let you tell the story, but it's you went to the East, and there was an elderly Indian physician who very politely said to you, "What do you mean by consciousness?"
Yes, well, he kind of caught me unawares. I was in New Delhi delivering several lectures to Indian physicians about the role of consciousness in health and illness. This was back in the late 80s, 1980s, and I thought that this whole idea of my going and informing Indian doctors about consciousness was kind of crazy in the first place, because they've only been talking about consciousness in the mind for about 5,000 years in India. So, you know, why was an American doctor talking to giving them advice about this sort of thing? But I found it to be a great experience, because I, for the first time in my professional life, I really saw that we really don't know very much about some of the fine points of consciousness in the Western world. For example, they have over 50 levels and states of consciousness in the transcendental level, and on the empirical physical level, where we, you know, the stuff of the mind begins to operate, such as our thoughts and feelings and so forth. They have over 40 states of and levels of awareness. So they just simply wanted me to be a little bit more specific when I used a word like mind and consciousness. It only took me that question to realize that I was really outclassed in my understanding of what consciousness and mind are all about. It was a very humbling experience, but they were very kind and gentle with me, and at least I was able to inform them of some of the recent research in mind-body health, which they were not aware of. So it was humbling, but yet a very inspiring experience all in all.
Yeah, it seems like it sent you on a journey, but it seems like your journey started kind of at birth, because you're a twin. And then you married one, right? So, I mean, this whole idea of this connectedness and this ether was not necessarily new for you. It just took you to a greater exploration.
Well, the main influence in my writing this book, The One Mind, owes to the fact that I am an identical twin. And, yes, I am married to a twin. Barbara and her twin brother have had experiences all of their life, as my twin brother and I have, of sharing thoughts and feelings at a distance, even when we were unaware that the other twin was having the same thing going on. And so I have really been sort of primed from day one in my life to pay attention to the things that connect us at a distance, at a mental and sometimes physical level, which we really don't have a place for in our culture, as you well know.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. You know, and then you went off and you became a doctor, and you've had, and in the book that we're going to go through kind of systematically, because you've been a doctor, and people are obviously okay with telling you what it is they're experiencing, whether they're having near death and all of these other things, it makes you quite an extraordinary messenger for what it is that you do, which I think is wonderful. And your book crosses so many disciplines. Yeah, no, well, you know, sometimes we look at what is life purpose, right?
Yes.
Why are we here? What is our purpose? And it just seems to me, looking at the tapestry of work that you've done, it is definitely very rich and very needed in our society. So I thank you for taking that on and becoming a voice for it in a very big way.
Well, you know, I've tried not to speak about it at certain times in my life, but I find, Karen, that my life doesn't work very well when I sit on things that I know are important. And
right.
So many years ago, I just decided to speak about these issues, even though at the time it wasn't the very best way to advance my career in medicine, because, as you well know, a lot of this stuff really is thought to be really far out there, and a lot of people just really don't want to hear about it.
I know, isn't that weird? But what I find, even reading your book and people that I talk to, because I live in an area and I'm assisting my mom at the moment, and there's a lot of people who are much older, and they'll say to me, shh, you know, but don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And they're all closet cases. I mean, it's like, come on, you guys, get out of the closet. So I do understand, but the experiences are pervasive, and that's what I think is so interesting. So here's the question to you. You know, in the book, you should work things in the book. And one thing I think is interesting is Krishna is with us. He's a friend of mine. He's of the East persuasion.
Uh-huh.
And he might jump in and chime.
And Kevin.
he's also a scientist himself. So here's the question I have you. In your book, you start out basically, what are the old views of science and what are the new views? You know, you kind of, there's an old paradigm and there's a new paradigm.
Yeah. Well, the old paradigm is one of isolation and separateness. You know, we inherited
right.
this from physics, beginning with Isaac Newton only about 300 or 400 years ago. And we've come to a view in the world where we're just like a bunch of billiard balls bumping into each other. And there's really no intrinsic connection. The forces are all mechanical. And so unity and oneness may be okay for poets to talk about, but that's not really who we are. We're separate, we're individuals, and we have an emphasis on individuality and the self. The new paradigm goes beyond that, and it says that although we do have aspects of ourselves that are individual and separate, at a deeper level, we really do have an intrinsic connectedness, so that no matter how far apart we are in space or in time, there are ways in which we are intimately united that forms a unity and a whole. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize in this book at the level of consciousness. We come together and form a mind which cannot be separated. This allows for things that are just impossible at the old paradigmatic level. We can share thoughts at a distance. We can exchange feelings at a distance and so on.
Well, your book also, what I think is beautiful, is it bridges the new science with ancient wisdom. And you have quite a few examples in your book that relate to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. I talk about, you know, that there's nothing new about this idea of oneness and unity. The Akashic records are a model that goes back to 3,000 years in ancient India. The tenets of Buddhism and Hinduism are riven with this idea of connectedness and oneness. And even in the New Testament, we find comments such as Jesus saying, I and the Father are one, the kingdom of heaven is within. All of these allusions to oneness and unity are out there if we could just open up our minds and recognize them.
Now, here's another question. You start the book with the very first chapter is, why do we take risks? And I think some of this relates to some of your own experiences that you've had that relate to your time when you were a doctor in Larry?
Yeah.
Yeah, when you were a doctor in Vietnam War and
uh-huh.
some of the risk you take. But you also talk about this gentleman who saved somebody off of when he was jumping. What was he? Had a sort of a seizure and fell off the platform. So I'll let you explain, because there's a part of us that's intrinsically empathetic.
Well, that's exactly right. I start the book with the question, why would anyone risk their life to save somebody else? This was very personal for me because I was involved in many instances like this in Vietnam, where the question was, am I going to put my life on the line to save someone else? I was a battalion surgeon out in the boonies in Vietnam in 1968 and 69, and so this became a real issue for me. And the story that I lead off with in the book is that of Wesley Autry, who was a black man about in his late 40s, and he was standing on a subway platform in New York City in Midtown, and he noticed a young man having a seizure. The young man fell onto the subway tracks, and Autry jumped down to try to get him back up on the platform, but he couldn't do it. And he saw a train coming, and so he put the man parallel to the in between the tracks and the little depression there, and lay down on him, covering the young man's body with his own. He was almost decapitated because he had grease from the undercarriage of the train before the train was able to stop. But nonetheless, he was able to save this young man at extreme risk to his own life. I began to read about ideas that have been offered by people like Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, about someone, why someone would do this. And Campbell's answer was that at the decisive moment, the person who is the rescuer feels so intimately connected with the person in need that really he will do anything to save that person, even at the risk of his own life, because at that moment, there are not two people who are involved. Their minds, their consciousnesses have fused and come together to the extent that the person who's doing the rescuing is not rescuing someone else. He's really rescuing his own self. And I know this sounds very bizarre unless people find themselves in this and can prove this for themselves. That's what I did in Vietnam in more than one instance, which I go into in the book.
And you talked about you weren't supposed to do that. You'd made a promise to your family that you wouldn't, but you still defied it.
Well, that's true. And I was very troubled about that when I came back from Vietnam because I really even began to doubt my own sanity looking back on the crazy ways I behaved. I almost was destroyed in a situation in which I jumped into a crashed helicopter site and rescued a young man, a pilot, who was trapped. And the plane, the helicopter was supposed to explode, but fortunately it didn't. And those kinds of instances really shook me up. And I couldn't imagine that I would have violated the vows that I made before I went to Vietnam to my family and for those who love me. I swore that I would never take any unnecessary risks. But I hadn't been in Vietnam for 6 weeks until I was violating all of those vows and promises, and it was as if they didn't exist. And so this idea from Joseph Campbell that we take risks like that and put our life on the line for somebody else is because we feel so totally at one with them that we really are essentially the same person when it comes down to it.
Well, that goes to, in your book, you're referencing a lot of different scientific minds that are basically conferring with you. And one was the Feynman, where he says, we know that the subatomic particles of the constitution of atoms demonstrate a weird property called entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you also referenced Schrodinger. You want to mention how that works?
Exactly. I'm really keen in the book to try to illustrate to people that this is just not my idea. There have been some of the greatest minds of the 20th century that have echoed and affirmed this idea that consciousness is one. We all have our heroes in science, and one of my great heroes in science is the Nobel physicist Erwin Schrödinger, whose wave equations lie at the heart of quantum physics. And Schrödinger wrote about the nature of consciousness, and he just said flat out that there is only one mind. The great physicist David Bohm also said that all consciousness comes together in oneness at some dimension. And so I take pains to show that some of the greatest scientists who have thought deeply about the nature of consciousness in the 20th century are on board with this idea that if we go deeply enough, we see that all minds come together to form a single mind. This was certainly Schrodinger's idea, but not just his. I talk about many other scientists in the book who follow the same line of thinking.
Like Brahm. And this goes back to that whole notion of entanglement and how does it show. And the one other thing that you're referencing in the book, is, which I think makes perfectly good sense, is the whole idea of how mathematics and chaos theory and fractals work. So if you want,
well, that's true. There are many mathematical and scientific models that we can rely on to get a feel for this idea of oneness between things that are even far off from one another, spatially and physically. But this idea of entanglement really is a key idea currently that helps us model and make a picture of how our oneness actually might work. Back in the 1970s and 80s, this idea of entanglement really began to take root in science. And basically it was felt that this applied only to subatomic particles. And the entanglement idea is that if they have been in contact at one point and you move these particles far apart, even to the opposite ends of the universe, if you change one, the other changes instantly and to the same degree. It's as if they behave as a single united particle, even though they are far apart. Now, the hot observation in science is that this entanglement business operates not just at the level of subatomic particles, but at the level of biology, of plants and animals, and even people. So it's not that we're making up this idea of entanglement, and it's not just something that's a pretty word. It's not just metaphor or poetry. It really has been affirmed in scientific experiments to show that we couldn't be apart even if we wanted to. So this oneness is not something, you know, that is just California woo-woo stuff. It is has been affirmed now at the most hardcore level of science and actual observations and experiments.
You know, it's interesting. I did an issue called The Cosmic Gateway, and it came from an understanding, because you mentioned this in your book as well, the difference between self-induced sort of states of nirvana or ones that are more induced by taking psychoacoustic drugs. Uh-huh. And one thing that comes in is the notion of when people either have an out-of-body experience or have sort of an understanding of an aha. A lot of times, you know, remember in the 60s, it was all the Paisleys. To me, that's an awareness of the fractal nature of the universe and how everything is interconnected. And we are, then the other part you bring up is the idea of the whole, but we're a piece, like a drop of the ocean.
Right.
Those are two metaphors that sort of go, so we are still part of the sea.
You know, people have a hard time getting their minds around this oneness thing because everything about our see, touch, and feel world tells us that we're separate. We're different from other people. And I think it really helps to come up with some sort of metaphor that can help us understand how, yes, we are individuals. We are separate in many ways, but we are also identical and united in one. And this idea of the wave in the ocean or the drop of ocean water in the ocean as a whole expresses what scientists call a complementarity. And that's where things are both and. They can be united and separate. And so this has become a real issue in differentiating modern physics from the old Newtonian classical mechanical physics. In the old idea, we are separate. We bounce off of each other, but we never really come together. But in the new view with complementarity, we see that a particle can be a wave and a particle at the same time. This is like the drop of water being the same thing as the ocean, but it's actually totally different from it in terms of power and extent and so on. So this idea that we can be same and different at the same time, I think is a really helpful way to understand our oneness with each other, yet preserving our idea that we are individuals.
That goes back to your notion in the book, and I had Rupert Sheldrake on the book, the morphogenic field, and it's like being a part of a TV a TV show, you're turning into different channels depending, and that's where the molecules bond, is with frequency. And right? So that, to me, totally makes sense. But the other part that goes back to, and then what do you turn on to? And I'm going to go back into this, because Rupert Sheldrake goes into the whole notion of nature, which you bring up in the book. I have to tell you, you kept up with like another twist and another twist and another way to think about it. So I really, really loved the book. It's like, okay, well, let's do this. So how does nature fit into this equation?
Well, I think it fits into the equation because we no longer view nature as something out there that we approach, and, you know, it's the world out there. We use that expression. Well, the world out there is who we are. When you drill down to a more elemental level, you find that you cannot secede from nature. This message is really not new. It's been the keystone message of the ecology movement for the better part of a century. It's a very dangerous view to say that nature is out there, we're here, we can take dominion over it and manipulate it and do what we want with it, because we're really not part of it. If we're going to survive on the earth, we're going to have to revise that idea to understand that we are a part of that world. It's not out there. We're all in it together, and this is a mixture from which we cannot divorce ourselves. I think this gets down to an idea which may seem sort of far out, but the idea of love is really key here to understanding what is going on. Love is an experience in which we feel that the boundaries between ourselves and someone else have just totally gone away. You can see this in the relationship between a mother and her infant. There aren't any walls separating them. They come together in terms of caring and affection, and we might as well call it what it is. It is just pure love. And so this gets back to something the novelist Alice Walker said. She said that anything we love can be saved. And so the thing that we need to save these days is our own future and our belongingness in this earth. Because if we don't, we're not going to be able to meet the problems that confront us, such as global warming, acidification of oceans, pollution, overpopulation, on and on and on. And so the question becomes, what do we love? What are we willing to take the boundaries away from so that we enter into it at such an intimate level that we want to save it, because in so doing we realize that we're saving ourselves? I think this idea of oneness is going to be key to how we're going to meet the real problems that confront our species now. And we are at a critical time, because unlike all the other generations that have come before us, we can see that we may be glimpsing the end unless we play the cards right.
You know, I think I used to run a school for kids, and what I kept trying to bring in was the fact that we it's one big living organism that we live in, and that includes the universe itself. It's a very dynamic interplay of all of these interconnected weaving systems. And I think the one thing that I was critical was to understand that we live on an organism which actually sustains and supports us, and it actually is like the mother. And like a mother, you know, breathes us, you know, warms us, bathes us. And when we don't nurture the mother, which is Mother Earth, or even the mothers, then we really do have a key problem. And we've been gifted this amazing world where we have, at least at this earthly level, these five senses that we basically operate in, which are all based on magnetic and electric stimulation. And yet there are the other senses, Larry, that you're going into the book, the seventh sense. And the sixth sense. So why don't we go into the notion of how we do sense our world, and to actually recognize that even Earth is made of the same stuff that we are.
Well, I think that's right. You know, Sheldrake has talked about some seventh sense that goes beyond the idea that information is transmitted through signals and electromagnetic pulses and this sort of thing. And this comes through his attention to how we can know something at a distance in ways that are commonly called ESP and telepathy and clairvoyance and so on. You know, if you look at the studies that have been done in this field, you will find that people have really tried to find sort of signal that might help explain why you can understand the thoughts and feelings and sensations of someone, say, who is on the other side of the earth. The problem is that nobody's been able to find a signal that passes from one person to another to convey this information. And so the image that comes out of this is that somehow we're so intimately connected, even at a distance, that we are, in a sense, one. The idea of separation just doesn't make any sense anymore. And so we need to convey and apply this idea of connectedness not just between different people at, who may be quite far apart, but we need to extend this principle to the world at large. Only by doing that are we going to be able to develop the level of empathy that's going to be required if we're going to save our skins in this these problems that we face, which we just mentioned. You know, I think that this is so crucial that we ought to revisit some models that have helped us, such as the golden rule, which is an expression in all the world's major religions. We say that the golden rule is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But this idea of oneness allows us to up the ante and rejig and revise the golden rule to say something like this: be compassionate and kind to others, because in some sense they are you. And this just sort of changes the level of intensity with which we're able to commit to doing something, because in so helping save other species and the earth itself, perhaps, we realize that we're saving ourselves.
Oh yeah. So here, there's a part in the brain, and the part in the brain. Here's the part in the question, and I think these are the things that you know you would call for the scientists the elephants in the room. And one would be, how does matter literally produce consciousness? Does it? And if so, you know, is consciousness confined to the brain? So I'm going to let you go off from there.
Yeah. Well, the old idea that I was schooled with, and which your kids still get sort of dragooned with, that they go off to college and take any courses in elemental biology, the idea is that somehow the brain produces consciousness, like the liver produces bile, you know. But the problem is that has never been observed. Nobody has any idea how the brain could make something that we experience as consciousness. And so this really boils down to a matter of what I call neuromythology. It's a faith-based idea that materialists hang on to because they simply don't want to go in any other direction. We have to keep the consciousness in the mind, in the brain. Otherwise, you know, we'll fall into fantasy and God knows what else. So that's the old idea. The problem is that forces you to deny a lot of other observations and experiences people have, which cannot be explained by just saying that it's all in the brain. I go into, in the book, The One Mind, a lot of examples which show that consciousness can do things that brains just simply cannot do. And so we need another model. An example would be how people can share thoughts who are far apart. Brains can't do that. I mean, they're stuck in the present. If you follow the way of thinking in materialistic science, you have to deny that those things are even possible. But they
I like
are
the idea that you have. The idea of the TV set where is where the your TV still is still here. It's being transmitted to. It's receiving information. But if the TV set gets broken, does that mean that the stuff is still not out there? And the truth is, it's still going on, whether your TV set is broken or it's decided you could look at that as reincarnation. So, which you also talk about in the book.
Well, that's
There's
right.
Some really interesting examples. Oh God, that was the one about the boy with his hand. Explain that one. That was like, whoo.
Well, let me lay one on you, which is sort of central to my idea of being a twin. I love this example because I am one, and my twin brother and I, as I mentioned, have had these weird experiences all of our life. This has to do with a case that was reported in Spain a few years back, and it had to do with a couple of 4-year-old identical twin girls, and they were named Sylvia and Marta. And one day, the father took Sylvia away to visit the grandparents, who were tens of miles away, and Marta stayed home to help her mother with household chores. So what happened, unfortunately, was that Marta, helping her mother, touched her hand to a red-hot iron and erupted in a big second-degree burn, a big fat blister on one part of her palm. And immediately at the same time, as it turned out, her sister, tens of miles away, also erupted with a second-degree burn on the same hand, on the same place on the hand, in the same shape. And this was investigated by teams of researchers, and photos were taken, doctors' reports were obtained. So this is a situation in which we see oneness between two distant people just really erupting in everyday life. You know, skeptics are just driven nuts by this sort of thing because they have no explanation for how this could happen. And this is the sort of thing that forces us to revise our idea about whether or not we're connected. I don't see any way of coming to terms with those kinds of experiences, of which there are hundreds that have been reported, without coming up with some model or picture or image of consciousness in which we say that we're somehow united, no matter how far apart we are.
Well, you know, the other thing that made me think of, Larry, was this, because if you're an identical twin, that means your geometry, everything is the same. And the question was, and you mentioned so many times in the book, how even if these twins were divided at birth, the parallel things that happened to them separately were so identical, from names to kids to experiences to breaking their legs. Then the question is there a destiny all the while you're still, you know, creating your own reality to a point? But there also seems like in reading the book that there's a destiny with people.
Well, it does sound, yes, I think there is a destiny. If I had to express it in just unequivocal terms, I would say that that's sort of the destiny of everybody. I mean, we see this amped up in identical twins because they have a lot of factors going for them that I think make them prone to share this sort of thing, even at a physical level. But we see the same sorts of intimate interconnections at a distance in non-twins, just as we see it in twins. It's just that the intensity level in twins is increased. But we know now from research in twins that only about 20% of identicals experience these same sorts of weird intimate sharings at a distance. So most identicals don't, and the question becomes, I think, is there a factor that explains even the connections between twins as well as possibly connections between non-twins? And I think we do. And it has to do with emotional closeness. We mentioned love a moment ago. And you see these strange, weird connections in twins who really do love each other intensely and really almost luxuriate in this idea of emotional connectedness. And I can tell you as a twin that not all twins feel this way. A lot of twins really don't want that kind of closeness because they have trouble individuating and becoming individuals and developing their own individual identities. And so the last thing they would want to do would be to share this kind of closeness. So not all identicals, therefore, demonstrate this sort of thing. And even in people who are not twins, the factor which seems to set these kinds of weird experiences in motion is love. People who are emotionally bonded, emotionally close, such as lovers and bonded spouses and so on, are the people that you would expect these sorts of events to occur in the lives, and so that's what we see. So love is a huge factor, and you can't understand these kinds of experiences without bringing emotions and emotional closeness into the equation.
Emotion and emotional closeness.
Well, so here's another question that comes, because in
social
the book.
Closeness. Yeah,
in the book I thought was really interesting is the whole notion of reincarnation. And there was one guy who had the birthmark, which was Tal, and he kept saying when he was really young, Tal, 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 and he actually found where he was, and he came back with the birth defect. And you're talking about birthmarks and things like that. So it goes back into the whole idea of the continuation and that it's infinite and it never dies.
Well, I think that's just another expression of oneness that persists through time. You know, there's several ways to talk about one. One is where our closeness is so extreme that we behave as one, even though we're far apart spatially. But we can also be far apart in time, not just in space. And reincarnation really is a way of talking about closeness that extends across time. The boundary here that's done away with is the assumption that separateness involves past, present, and future. Well, reincarnation just shoots that idea down. It says that we can be related to other beings and expressions of ourselves across across time, not just space. So I'm glad you bring reincarnation in, because it expands the idea of oneness, not just from spatial separation, but temporal separation as well.
Yeah, your book touches on so many things. I just kept going and kept going. And one of the, I liked when you talked about, you did mention the confusion of identity when people come back from reincarnation, and sometimes there's those notions that are confused. That you know, I'm coming in from an existing pre-existence, and I maybe haven't transitioned the way that, you know, I'm trying to have the different experience, but maybe I'm not ready.
Well, you know, Karen, you brought up the analogy of the television set tuning into an external frequency. You know, television sets don't always function properly. The channel changer can, to put it quite mildly.
Okay.
And so I think the idea is that the brain can function also as a kind of a receiver. And so the brain doesn't always function maximally and smoothly either. And so the brain may jumble the transmission job and confuse people as to where they came from, the continuity of their identity, and so on, may be totally jumbled up by a faulty receiver, which is the brain. So there are so many factors that can come into the equations here when we talk about how well people perceive their continuity from one life to another, which has to do with physical factors such as the efficiency of the brain, and to say nothing of the social conditioning that all of us receive, which usually, at least in our culture, says that none of this is impossible anyway. So there are all sorts of mitigating factors against people really getting the message correctly.
You're talking about your whole neural network and what's plugged in and what gets tuned off and how it actually is wired. And that would make a difference on how we actually receive the stimuli, which goes into another topic of the book, which I really liked. And it goes back to the you talk about it as a maneuvering wave or the morphogenic field of, like, the flock, which also goes into the collective consciousness, which I think is an interesting, because it's not just an individual, as you're saying, this is a one mind, and so the collectiveness also works in symphony with each other. So if you think of the flocks of birds when they're flying, I'm going to let you describe that, because it's really, you know, I hadn't even thought of it that way when you think of nature, but then again, we do swarm and do the same things.
Well, that's right. I think some of the best information and evidence that we have that consciousness comes together and operates as a single entity can be found in the behavior of flocks of birds and schools of fish and herds of animals and so on. And actually, this has been tested by people like Sheldrake, who has looked at this phenomenon in animals, particularly dogs, but also... ethologists have been out in the wild looking at, for example, at herds of caribou. Hundreds of thousands of these animals seem to behave as a single entity. There have been some sophisticated studies showing that there isn't any way to describe this collective instantaneous behavior in these huge groups of animals by just saying that, well, they do this because they see their neighbor changing, and, you know, it's kind of like a bunch of dominoes, one sending a message to the other, and so on throughout the whole herd. They change so instantaneously and in such synchrony that there isn't time for the propagation of signals through see, touch, hearing, and all that sort of thing to explain their group behavior. And Sheldrake and many other ethologists have come up with the idea of group behavior, of group mind that is possessed by the group as a whole to explain these instantaneous behaviors. You see this not just in herds of animals like the great buffalo herds that used to exist and the wildebeest herds and the caribou herds that still exist. As mentioned, you see it in huge flocks of birds, particularly starlings. They seem to be the winners here in the bird kingdom, and also in fish like schools of sardines and such, which when they're chased by a predator, say a shark, they will just explode instantly and move in all different directions at once to confuse a predator. This is instantaneous behavior, practically. And so, you know, we just try to figure out if it isn't propagated by sight and sound and so on, what's the mechanism? So many of us are proposing the idea of a one-mind type phenomenon, a group mind that is shared instantly among all the members of the group.
Well, you know, it goes to me as like, you know, we turn on our own little channel and choose where we tune in, but then there's still the TV set that people turn into every day, which is their news channel. Mm-hmm. That also creates a mindset. So to me, it's just a bunch of minds turning into the same channels and then creating what you're calling a herd mentality. And again, as you're stating in the book, a society can choose to fail or succeed based on what they're tuning into.
No, I think we have to be careful about what we're turning into. You know, one of the problems we're up against, Karen, with this idea of the one mind is that we tuned into the wrong channel, I think, pretty persistently for the better part of a couple of hundred years. The channel that we've turned into is the one that tells us none of this is possible. If you people think that you can share thoughts and feelings and so on at a distance, you're just deceiving yourselves. So you need to keep the channel on the materialistic idea that the mind is produced by the brain and it's confined to the brain in the present. Unfortunately, that just won't cut it any longer. It won't cut it because it can't explain the evidence.
No, you know, we remember the first time I reached out to you to be in the magazine was I was doing questioning science. And what had come to me is some of the talks that had been X'd on TED, and they didn't even let you get up. and what I thought was really pervasive across the people that I reached out to, it was all those who were saying, you are more powerful than you know.
Yep.
And that was something to me that was like, oh, that's a flag. I got it. Because if you knew how beautiful you were, and how powerful you were, you would not follow the mentality of having people say, "Oh my God, that's too weird, that's too woo woo." And the people that I'm being with my moms and her friends would not say, "Oh, please don't, we can't talk about it, because then people will think I'm weird."
Yep.
And yet they're all having these weird experiences.
Well,
and so it has become a taboo, and it's terrible.
Well, you know,
go ahead, Larry.
I've been in medicine for a good many years, and I've had a lot of opportunities to talk to large groups of doctors about these weird goings-on. I'll relate one experience I had. I wrote a book which you and I talked about some time ago about premonitions, and I, during the first year I was in medical practice, began to have precognitive dreams about my patients, which would get played out a few days later or the next day in exotic detail. And I this really unnerved me because I knew the world couldn't work like that, but there it was. And I tried to share these experiences with some of my colleagues, but they didn't want to talk about it. And so I just sort of put the whole thing on the back burner. Until years later, I did write the book because of increasing evidence from laboratory studies that this stuff really happens. And so I was asked to talk to groups of physicians from time to time about how premonitions or precognitions can be a factor in medical practice. And I'll never forget, about 3 years ago, I was asked to talk to a group of doctors at a continuing medical education conference sponsored by Harvard Medical School, and they wanted me to talk about something what they call different. So I thought, boy, premonitions are different. That's what I'll talk about. And I made a fool of myself by describing to them my own experiences. And I thought, well, this will probably result in my never getting reinvited here. You know, they're not going to go along with this. And I thought that they would all get up and leave, but they didn't. And in the Q&A session, they began to tell me their experiences. And they would almost all begin with the comment that, you know, I've never told anybody this in my life, but, and then they would go on to describe their weird experience. And there was one female internist who popped up in the middle of this big group, and she said, well, I get numbers in my dreams. She said, I see the exact laboratory values of my patient's lab tests in my dreams before I even order the tests.
Oh, wow.
So this woman had never told anybody this before because I gave them permission, you know, to be weird. I'd already sort of embarrassed myself by talking about my weird precognitive dreams. They felt safe in coming forward and changing their channel, so to speak, about what they were willing to talk about. And I think that these examples are so important. This non-local knowing, this idea that we're not stuck in the present and in the brain, but we can access via the one mind information that can be important to our health. I have a colleague, Larry Burke, who has collected a series of case reports of breast cancer in which the woman dreamt the specific location in her breast where the pathological cancer was growing before there was even any evidence for it, before the mammogram became abnormal, and before it was even capable of being felt on a breast exam. So this is not just woo-woo stuff. This is important in people's actual lives. And it's been fascinating to me as an internist to see how this gets played out sometimes in health and illness.
Well, you know, there's a in the same issue that you were in, there was images of this pneumoscope that had been around, I think, during the 40s or whatever, which evidently somehow went missing in the night. And it showed, like, 3 million times of an atom, and it showed all of the rays and all of the interconnectedness that are happening at the subatomic level. It was amazing. And so when we think of connectedness and we look at how, because I've given you a preview to my book, you can see all the webs and how the how a spider web works. You can see how the internet works. You can see how all these webs and connects work. And it exactly, to me, is in how we connect through the ethers, through these fields that we still don't see, just like now with the telephone. It mm-hmm. is the same idea. And so for us to think that it doesn't exist is, to me, is kind of crazy. That goes back to this idea. How does one connect with the cosmic soup?
Well, I want to say that we don't understand how individual mind works, let alone all that we need to know about how the one mind, the distant mind, the inclusive mind works. In the book, I make several models and talk about how we may eventually come to understand this, but I think that we're pretty far away from it, from a proper understanding of it currently. You know, my position now, as someone who's intensely interested in scientific modeling, I'm willing to go with the evidence and put off the explanation a little bit longer. I think that's only responsible because, for example, in medicine, in my field, we often know that something works before we have a clue about how it works. For example, penicillin and aspirin and just a whole bunch of things, even general anesthetics, we know that they work, but we don't understand really how they work. I think we're in the same position with the one mind, the non-local mind, as I call it. We know that it works. I don't think there's any question about that personally. I don't think we have the best explanation yet, but that's not an excuse for not honoring the fact that the evidence shows that this is real. So I'm willing to... go ahead.
There's parts in the book that you're giving clues that it exists. I think that you're talking about where does creativity come from and where do those aha moments come from, and it's like they're being downloaded.
Yeah, I don't doubt that they work. I mean, the book is just full of data points showing that. Look, folks, get with it. This stuff is real. Let's stop kidding ourselves and saying that we're deceiving ourselves, because this is not fantasy. Here's the evidence. So, that's the premise of the book. Wake up. Let's honor this. I mean, the data points in that direction. So, my challenge to people who really want to dig deep and understand the operations of this and actually how it actually happens, I say go for it.
There's some really good clues, though, Larry, in the book, because one of them you're talking about is the language of the mind. And, I oftentimes get visuals when I'm asking a question. And
right.
Some of that doorway is asking, right? So I do get visuals. And a lot of these people get them either through their dreams or through those, you know, which I get them that way, or I just, you know, I lay down and things come to me, I actually get little voices sometimes, and I'm okay.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right? And so there are aspects of how do we receive. And I think I always think when I did my own book that I'm working on, it's so incredibly visual because that way there's no other interpretation.
Well, you showed me a preview of your book, and I must say that the visuals are so stunning that I think it's a hugely important contribution. And the visual way of tapping into all of this information is hugely important. As I talk about in the book, there was a survey of the world's greatest physicist a few years back, and the surveyor wanted to know how people like Einstein got their insights. And a lot of people think, well, they reason them mathematically. You know, they do the math and the calculus and so on and come up with the conclusion. And Einstein said, no. The earliest phase is almost completely visual. And then they dress it up in equations and mathematics at a later stage of understanding. So I think the visual stuff is really important. One person I talk about in the book is Thomas Edison, the great inventor, American inventor, who came up with the phonograph record and moving pictures and the electric light bulb and on and on and on. And he is on record as saying, I never have created anything, which is a kind of a jaw-dropper because, you know, you think if anybody is a good creator and inventor, it's got to be Edison. But he said, I get pictures from the outside. And he said, it doesn't come from my mind. He said, I get impressions from the universe. And those were visual impressions. So I think that you're really onto something here. I think the visual pathway is one that is hugely influential on how we access information from what I'm calling the one mind.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I'd hosted Michal Leswick many times in Vancouver, and he kept saying, I remember in a conversation we had, he said, the universe uses visuals in order to and that's the universal language of things, and I thought, and that stuck with me. So when I saw that in your book, I said, oh, yeah. And that, you know, that goes back to the whole notion of how we receive, and so what is DNA, and are things predetermined? Is DNA like the antenna that's really just the receiver and the transducer? And is the brain, therefore, outside of it receiving from a greater thing? I think when I did my book, you know, when I was thinking of Merkel, but, you know, not, I was thinking of those Russian dolls, right? There's systems embedded within systems, embedded within systems. And it always struck me, there's a system within us, we're living within a system, and there's a big old cosmos out there, and just like we're getting bombarded with our own neural network shocks, the Earth is getting bombarded, what is it, like a million times a minute with electrical currents. It's getting its own feedback, and I thought, are those really one and the same? And I used to imagine when I was driving up to my mom's house in Utah, and the light in the sky would be lit up with thunder and lightning. I thought, is that the brains of God? I mean, it just all looked one and the same.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's beautiful.
I'm sorry. Anyway.
You know, one of the things...
Think of all those things.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One of the things that fascinates me is what sort of mental state must we be in order to receive those visuals?
Mm.
And if you look at how people tap into the so-called one mind or the source or the pool of information, whatever we choose to call this, there are some similarities from person to person. Usually, it involves some sort of method of putting the rational, waking, busy mind out of the way and letting some deeper source of wisdom well up and surface the kind of awareness that may pop up during dreams when the rational mind just sort of steps aside. And the ways that people have chosen over the years to access this receiving situation is pretty common. I guess if you had to pick one, it would be meditation or contemplation or whatever term we would want to apply to it, in which we just sort of put the rational, analytical mind to one side and just see what happens elsewhere. I think that's one reason why so much of this information pops up in dreams and reverie and quietness and so on. So it's no accident.
No accident that
a lot of these things happen, you know, when people are sort of daydreaming or experiencing what is called reverie or contemplation and so on.
Yeah, I know when I was working on the book years ago, it would make me tired, so I would shut my little mind down and sit down and lay down for a few minutes.
You shut your little mind down and let your big mind open up.
That's what it was. Okay, one more question, because I know we've got 4 minutes, but I think this is important. When you would watch people and they would have their near-death experiences, right? And there was always those common things, and I think it goes back to a feeling that most of them have, which comes back to love. So as we go to close the show, I think that is a point. Most people with near-death experience have certain common things. So why don't we go there, Larry, and then, because I think that ends exactly where we began, which is the notion of the love part.
Yes. Well, you know, everybody's heard of NDEs by now. There are about 15 million people who are estimated in the United States alone who have had a near-death experience, and a lot of this is pretty well known. People know about the tunnel, the light, and so on, that is commonly described by people who have had near-death experiences. The one I keep coming back to, however, is this feeling of profound connectedness and love. People who come back from near-death almost always talk about a sense in which they felt connected with absolutely everything there is. And all of this feeling of oneness and unity and connectedness is marinated in a profound sense of intense love. You can't understand the near-death experience without talking about love. And these people, when they come back, their lives are completely transformed. They want to do whatever they can do to help others because of a profound sense of empathy and caring. So love is just part of the near-death experience. And I think that's often left out. We tend to focus on the fireworks, such as the light and the tunnel and this sort of thing. But integral to all of that is love.
Yeah, the one part in the book it says, a lot of what you said was, a lot of people had to die to learn how to live. And I think that's a very poignant point in there.
Well, I think that's a very common situation. And so the feeling that love leaves with these people is one that really eradicates the fear of any future death. I think this is important to bring out. The fear of death and annihilation has caused more suffering in the history of the human race than all the physical diseases combined, I would suggest. And so this near-death experience shows a way out of that. It shows that a sense of connectedness and the love that goes with it is an antidote to this pervasive fear of death and annihilation that has been part of human history from the get-go.
Yeah, I think I got from the book is when we're on a continuum, and so I think to whatever part of your life isn't working, try to make it work as best as it can, because you can't get off the roller coaster ride. Because that one kid who came back and his hand had been severed and when he was really young and died came back with the same deformity. And I think there's lessons in it that you never really get out of until we actually find our way to love. And a lot of it basically says that's what we're here to do, period. And these situations that show up for us. Yeah, these situations are here to teach us to be that way. And, and I thank you so much for indulging me in the show and being on it. I'm so glad I reached out to you. And I really, really enjoyed the book. It just put things in it's so many threads that normally you just don't see together. And I thank you for that. And with that, Larry, you're welcome to sign off. I'm just going to say thank you to the Awakening Zone. So,
thanks, Karen. Let's do it again sometime.
Oh, absolutely. You know, send me another book. I mean, okay. They're so juicy. Thank you.
Best wishes. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, so here we are at the Awakening Zone. One, I want to thank the Awakening Zone always, because They have an inspired group of people and other hosts that the Crimson Circle offers hundreds of inspiring messages from Ascended Masters. Most of these are life-changing messages. They have a complete library. Go to thecrimsoncircle.com, and many more you'll find on an online store. I am so grateful. I love these guys, and thank you so much, everybody, for listening today. And with that, we'll sign off, and we'll close the show. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Awakening Zone Radio Network, offering insights and inspiration for our evolving consciousness.